You know what's funny? When you originally on this podcast said, like, I have a cackle, and I was like, you do not have a cackle. I later listened back to, I think it was like our first Scary Stories episode, and it was after the Domino's thing. You go, I used to work at a Domino's. Like, it was full on Maleficent, like, the evil queen of Snow White kind of vibe. It's like, holy shit, she does have a cackle.
Oh, it's witchy. I literally...
Oh, it's witchy. It's witchy, girl.
I have started training myself when I feel the cack coming on to pull myself backwards off the mic because I know I will... There was... Maybe it was that episode, but I remember we recorded... Maybe it was an After Dark, actually. But I cackled so hard into the mic and you were like, baby, you are blown out, or you made some blown out joke, because I literally was going to blow the freaking mic out.
It's just something about like the frequency or the tone of it. Yeah, when it's just a little too close, sometimes it does like the audio just goes fuzzy for a second because the mic can't handle it. But I don't want you to ever taper that down. I love your cackle.
Oh my God. Well, unfortunately, she is me. I am her.
That's one of their favorite things about you. The creepers love your laugh. They say that on Reddit all the time.
Well, just wait till we're in person. You go flying backwards.
Well, Miss Stu, I have got another episode teed up for you. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Creep Time, the podcast, by the way. This is, I said just a second before we started recording, this is going to be a little bit different because I said I've got a big story for you, but what I actually have are two different cases kind of wedged into one. So this kind of starts with a story that's breaking in real time, and you may actually be familiar with it because it's probably, I'm sure you've seen some news coverage of it, depends, you know, which outlets you're reading or watching, but it ties into a larger conspiracy theory that people have requested time and time again. So what we're first going to discuss here with the creepers, again, hi, babies. Thank you for suggesting this. They suggested that we look into the case of Riley Strain. Have you been following that at all?
Okay, I have heard of this.
You have? Okay. Yeah. It's very recent, like this month.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know it's happening right now because this is so embarrassing and terrible. But one of my news outlets is E! News on my Instagram feed. And I know I it's like a young guy, right?
Yeah, really young, 22 okay. years old.
And I also have seen like other news, but like that's where it's ringing a bell for me. I saw it on my Instagram.
I'm happy that you're qualified. You're like, I also take in other news. I read reputable sources and not just E! News. No, but E! News and like People Investigates, like that whole tier of like, tabloids yeah. turned like investigative journalists. That's a real thing. They do cover a lot of the breaking true crime stories. But we've talked about this before. I don't usually like to focus on stories that are breaking in real time because things change literally by the hour sometimes. So by the time this episode comes out, who knows if tomorrow there might be a new detail or like a groundbreaking reveal and kind of the episode feels dated. But that's kind of why I wanted to tie this into a much larger theory and conspiracy, because the question is Riley Strain the latest victim of the Smiley Face murders? Do you know anything about that?
No.
You're going to need to strap in, baby.
Okay, that sounds really freaky.
It is. I'll get into a little bit of a top line, of course, of Riley's case and then talk about how it ties into the Smiley Face murders. But I'm also, the second half of this, I'm going to talk a lot about that conspiracy, because it is driven by, I think, 3 to 4 former detectives, like highly decorated detectives from the NYPD, who have been pitching this theory that there is a connection to all of these murders, or a ring underneath the murders, that dates back all the way to 1997. So the question is Riley the latest victim? Now, you may have been following this, but I'll reiterate for anybody who's listening who does not know, but Riley Strain went missing in Nashville on March 8th of this month, 2024, and nobody has seen him since. So I am going to thank the person who suggested this. I know there were a lot of you, but I saw it first from username ccookie2373, which I'll also say, I'm happy to read the usernames, but definitely sign your name because I feel bad not like calling you by your name.
Sea Cookie,
except for Autumn Baby. Autumn Baby, you keep that name.
Oh, yeah. Autumn Baby and Kendra. Well, is Kendra her full name?
Kendra's her real name. That's in her username.
Oh, it's in her. Okay.
So but Kendra is Kendra. And Autumn Baby is Autumn. Well, Autumn might be her name. I don't know, actually.
Autumn Baby, you gotta let us know, girl.
But like, Autumn Baby is like it's a username that talks about a season, but it's also, it gives you like a warm, fuzzy feeling. Like, you couldn't do that with other seasons. Like, you're not gonna do like, I don't know, like, Ball Sweat Summer isn't gonna be a good username that I can read on the podcast.
Nobody take that as an idea. You know somebody's gonna
So this recommendation came from Ball Sweat Summer. No, Autumn Baby, we love you, girl. So again, thank you again to ccookie2373 for suggesting we look into this and that we follow this case. We are going to go over the most up-to-date information at the time that I researched this and the time that we're recording this, but I will say it again, new details can come out about these cases and this case specifically by the hour. So if something has changed by the time this episode goes live or there are new details, or God forbid, if you happen to be in the area and you might have seen something or do see something by the time you hear this, I'm going to include information in the description of this podcast where you can relay your tips. So we are first going to cover his case and talk a little bit about the trail and the timeline and then how this possibly connects to the Smiley Face murders. But before we do, I guess we should just say welcome back before we jump into it, just so we're not like off to the races right away. Welcome back, everybody. It's been a second and we missed you guys. How's everybody doing?
Hi, creepers.
Stu, you came on hot when you got on that mic today. Me riled up. I was like,
sorry.
I was like, okay, all right.
Creepers, I've had a week. I will change my energy.
That's not what I'm saying.
You know I won't, though, because I'm using this energy to get me fired up about who could potentially be behind this.
Well, it's going to be interesting to talk about because I don't have a lot of theories, per se. Like, who could I point to as a suspect? The only thing I could tie it to would either be what happened to Riley is probably accidental, but again, we have no body, so we have no crime or no case. But the other side of this is, could this really be connected to the conspiracy of the Smiley Face murder? So, like I said, I won't beat a dead horse. We'll get into all of it. Thank you again, everybody, for stopping by. Thank you for listening to Creep Time, the podcast. If you guys are new here, or if you're a longtime listener, you just don't like to listen to us when we give you these instructions, baby. Please follow and subscribe to the podcast. You can hit the bell notification so that you never miss when we drop surprise episodes. Ding, ding, ding. Thank you to all of the premium subscribers, everybody who signed up for the newsletter. Keep an eye out for that. And with that, honey, I'm ready to dive right in. Are you prepared?
I am not prepared, but I'm ready.
Ooh, I just felt a bead of sweat go down my torso.
Ball Sweat Summer, baby.
Stop it. Thank you again.
You and that electric blanket.
Stop. I don't have it on me. That's you know, I think it was overheating the other night. I sleep with it every night and I had it in my bed. And sometime around like 3 a.m, I woke up and the first thing I thought, I was like, I'm burning.
Oh.
I'm burning. Because it had like bundled up, like bunched up. So it was just a ball of heat laying on top of my body.
That's my worst nightmare.
I mean, I survived. Like, my defense was just kick the blanket off. It was okay, but that's what happened. Mm. So, let's get into the story. For anyone who is not familiar with Riley Strain's case, and I know you said you've seen a little bit about it, but you may not know the full context of how he went missing. Do you know anything about it, Stu?
I definitely don't. Okay. I just saw kind of like the top, like the quick headline.
Got it.
I knew it was in Nashville and I knew that they found something of his, but I didn't click into the article.
They did. Yeah, that's a pretty recent update, actually. So, like okay. I said, I mean, they could find more by the time this goes live or in the coming weeks. So for anybody who is not familiar, Riley Strain is a 22-year-old college student and fraternity member who is attending Missouri State University, which I think people refer to as Mizzou. Mizzou.
Okay.
Right?
Well, actually, that's University of Missouri.
Is it? Okay, wait, maybe yeah. I was, I'm pretty sure, like 95% sure that I read Missouri State University, but I could have gotten that mixed up. Mm. But they've also been calling him in headlines like he's a Mizzou student. So
okay.
Unsure. He's also a member of Delta Chi, which I figured you would know more about than I would. Greek life.
Well, is it Delta Chi?
Baby.
I'm sorry. I wasn't going to call you out, but from now on,
it's
Delta Chi.
Is it Delta Chi?
Chi.
Really?
Yes.
But isn't it like Phi when they say like PHI, like Delta Phi?
It is, but I knew there was a frat on my campus that was Chi Phi, spelled C-H-I.
I give up. Jesus.
But I do love chai. I mean, I love to envision it being chai.
Well, that's the frat that he's a part of. So here's where this story all kind of comes from. It was the weekend of March 8th, so very recent, where he was on a trip and he was on a night out with friends, members of his fraternity down in Nashville. This was supposed to be just like a downtown outing, and it was fairly early in the night. They ended up going to Luke Bryan's bar, which is called Luke's 32 Bridge and is located on Broadway for anybody who's local to Nashville or knows the area. But according to his tab that was on record and camera footage at the bar, allegedly, Riley was only served one drink at the bar and then requested two waters while he was there. So this is sometime between 9 to 9:30 p.m. So the request of the waters, to me, and you may feel differently about this, was kind of an immediate indication that he's hammered. He feels mm-hmm. sick to the point where he's like, okay, we need to transition from alcohol to water. But it's so early in the night. Not to say that you can't get wasted early in the night, but it just seemed odd. Maybe not.
Right. I definitely think I don't want to stereotype, but he's with his frat brothers. I don't think it's too far from the truth that he could have been drinking a lot that early.
Yeah. I mean, they've been really cooperative the entire way through because they were the first people, of course, to report him missing after this night. But I couldn't find any like verifiable quotes or anything where they said exactly how much he was drinking. The only thing I have found in the reporting is that he was just served one drink. But I find it extremely hard to believe that he was that drunk off of one drink. Unless there was something in the drink. So that's something we're going to talk about a little bit later. But by 9:35, Riley is escorted out by security. He is escorted from the bar. And they said in a statement it was for conduct violations, aka he's severely drunk. But for some further context, Riley physically, he's no stranger to drinking, right? He's in a frat. He drinks pretty regularly. He's a young kid. He's 22. He's 6'5". So everybody was saying he has a decent tolerance. So if he did, in fact, and again, I can't verify this because his friends haven't made mention of it. If he did, in fact, show up there and this was his first drink of the night, something's very wrong with that scenario. It is not entirely clear from the available timeline why exactly his friends did not immediately follow him out. I think there might have been one friend who tried to follow him down, but then had to go back up the stairs because he realized he was like, oh, I never like closed out the tab, like I never settled up. So let me go back upstairs, close that out, then come back outside expecting Riley to be down there so I can like walk him back to the hotel. By the time he got back down, Riley is gone. We then have this collection of cell phone data and camera footage, which has been used to piece together some of the story about where Riley went from 9:35 to 10 p.m., where he is suddenly gone. So what we know is that Riley immediately started walking, and by 9:47, he's caught on camera. I do have pictures I can send you of this, but for now, I'll keep going. Well, actually, maybe you've seen what he looks like, right?
Like, not blonde hair, but almost like I don't know. I feel like maybe blonde.
Yeah, no,
he's, or like kind of shiny hair is what I remember.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming blonde.
He's blonde. I'm going to see if I have any pictures of him, like, walking. But there's video footage, too, and I've seen him. Like on the street, he was like near blackout drunk.
Oh, God.
I mean, he's like falling face first into pavement kind of drunk.
Ugh.
Here, let me go ahead and just send you this. This is a shot. I'll send this in our chat, but this is a shot of Riley when he's walking down the street. And you can see, obviously, he's solo. He's wearing a very specific shirt. And I'll get into the shirt a little bit later and about when that comes back into the story. If there are any theories that it ties into, but that's what he looked like.
Can you just remind me, he's a junior?
I think he's a 22. I think he's a senior.
Oh, senior. Okay, senior.
I think so. I mean, I don't know, 22, 23. It could be junior, could be senior. He's he's not terribly new to the frat or to drinking, right?
Okay.
So he's on his own. By 9:47, he is caught on camera. And I think at this point, there were multiple cameras that caught him. Like I said, he is severely drunk. He's falling face first into the pavement. People are seeing him. Cars are passing him. But again, it's maybe not that odd to see somebody who's like blackout drunk on the street. But maybe, I mean, we could say in hindsight, like, why didn't somebody stop to see if like he needed, you know, a car or a cab or like where he was going? But easier said than done in a lot of circumstances, especially for a 6'5" stranger. So by 9:47, based on where his phone pinged and the camera footage that was released, Riley was crossing Gay Street. And there actually happened to be a cop on the street, which is so ironic and chilling in the context of this. There was a cop on the street who caught him on his body cam footage and actually approached him. So the cop was on the street for a totally separate reason. He's there for like a burglary call for a car or something. So he's there for like 45 minutes prior, kind of surveying the scene, happens to pass Riley, greets him, says something like, "How you doing?" And Riley kind of seems, I wouldn't say lucid, like, he's definitely still impaired, but not to the point where he's like, I felt like he's not slurring, right? Within just...
Like, you think he clocked that was a cop?
Oh,
like
he definitely... Yeah, he definitely knew. And sometimes that happens, too. Like, sometimes you can be really hammered, but the second that you're, like, in the presence of a cop, somehow you just, like, straighten up for a few seconds. Yeah. That's kind of what it seemed like, because the cop was like, "How you doing?" And Riley's like, "Doing well, how are you?" Like, just tried to be very confident that he was like, "I'm fine, I'm just going for a walk." It was maybe just 10 minutes after he saw that cop, and the cop was probably the last person to see him and catch him on camera. Riley seemed to vanish. His phone stopped pinging. He disappeared. No other witnesses seemed to see him after that. Nobody described any confrontations on the street, any fights or violence. Riley just vanished. But this interaction became incredibly important because I think this is right around 9:52. And the last time that his phone pinged was, again, near Gay Street, but also near this bridge. That's right at around 10. So something happened right around 10 p.m. We just don't know what. So, again, they were trying to get the phone data once he was reported missing later that night. And we would later, you know, reference some of the texts that are retrieved from Verizon. Allegedly, it was like pulling teeth for the family to get access to this. Like Verizon, I understand. We've talked about this before. There are protocols and like they have investigators in-house who have to do, you know, certain privacy protection protocols. But when someone is missing like this, it's kind of like every second counts, right?
Oh, totally. The more we cover cases like this where that happens with the phone companies, I'm just like, why is there not a law that lets you bypass somehow when it's a missing person? I just, especially if they're, obviously he's over minor age, but it's just, I know we've covered cases where like a minor goes missing and it's like pulling teeth to try to get their last pings.
You just made a good point, actually. I wasn't even thinking about that. He is an adult, so maybe that affords him a certain level of protection where like they can't just release requested data to a family. They have to verify that there is an open case. Police have to verify it. And we know how long that could take. Mm-hmm. So I can understand how things get held up, but eventually they do gain access to some of his phone data, which is where we see the phone pinging for the last time, right past Gay Street around 10 to 10:15. And we also get some final texts on his phone, clearly showing that he was probably very impaired. It's not entirely clear who this was, but it was definitely a girl that he was texting. And I think it was somebody he was seeing back in Missouri. And he just wrote to her, "Good, lops," like L-O-P-S, which people read very, very far into. I don't really know that that meant anything. I kind of thought just based on like where letters are stationed on a keyboard, he probably meant to say like, "Good, L-O-L." Right? Or, I mean, some people are like, maybe lops means cops. Like, there are cops near me.
Or maybe, like, he's trying to say good Lord or something, or I don't know. I'm
That's the thing. It's like, we'll never really know, but I'm also sort of questioning, like, is it all that relevant? I mean, it doesn't spell out anything nefarious to me that this is a girl that they were able to verify that he was seeing, but he went missing in Nashville. Like, I don't think there's any real connection there, but people are just grasping at straws for anything here. But what it told me was that he's definitely drunk, or he's impaired to the point where he's having difficulty spelling things. But the most important detail is that that text, like I said, comes between 10 to 10:15, and this is the last time that his phone ever pinged, as I mentioned before. Now, the location data of the final ping is pretty broad in terms of radius, so we do have a general area of where we know the phone pinged. We just don't know exactly where it was, but what we do know is it was in the opposite direction of the hotel. So why was he walking far away from the hotel? Why was he walking in the complete opposite way? Was he confused? Was he lost? Or was he going somewhere? Or was he running from something, trying to escape someone who was tailing him?
I mean, I don't know if you're asking me, but I feel like whenever you're visiting a town, your main thing when you're drunk or you don't feel good is to get back to home base. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine he was trying to. The only other thing I was going to think was maybe that he wanted to go to another bar or something and was going to try somewhere else. But it seems like based on him ordering the waters, he had already kind of tapped out himself.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. Actually, let me see if I can find you the map of his foot traffic. Let's see. Riley Street. Also, I saw somebody recently was like clocking us because they were like, when they look things up, how about they like cut that out, like cut that shit out, like that time. And I was like, baby, this is a 3-way phone call. Nothing gets cut out between you and I and like tens of thousands of creepers.
We can play some hold music. I'll start singing.
No.
You're like, please, God.
Let's see. Foot traffic map. I think what's important to like look at here is that the last place that his phone pinged, it is right by the water.
Yeah.
Doesn't spell a good story for me.
When you said last thing was by a bridge, I'm just thinking, oh God.
But you would think like, I mean, they've been doing aerial and water searches, like diving searches for weeks now. Like this is almost like 2 weeks in at this point and there's no sign of him. I just sent you a link.
Okay. Yep. I'm looking at it. Okay.
Like you can see where that cut off right by the bridge.
That's really, because it looks like it's right by the, okay, so that bridge is the gray. And I'm assuming you could drive over that bridge, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah, that just does not bode well for either falling in, obviously, into a body of water that looks pretty wide, or if it was somebody that got him, there's a conveniently a bridge right there to take him over into new territory away from Broadway and like downtown Nashville.
I have seen a couple of people on Reddit talk about this and they were like, well, the area that he was in is not known to be like a particularly nice area. It can be a bit rough. So there's a lot of talk about like, was he having a run-in with like the wrong crowd or like somebody on the street? Because there is quite a lot of foot traffic. But it's just shocking to me that nobody has really come forward as a witness after that cop saw him.
Right.
I mean, it was almost like, because the bridge is basically like right there. Like he sees him on the body cam footage and then like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's too much to assume that like somebody would have heard him fall off a bridge or fall into the water or something. I also had questions about his cell phone kind of going dark and like dead, like the second that it hits the water, if that's what happened. He had an iPhone 15, I'm pretty sure. Aren't iPhones pretty water resistant at this point? Maybe not.
They are, but you never know. I mean, they can be finicky. The thing that's coming to me right now looking at this is the fact that there's that public park that's right there next to the water.
Wait, let me see it. Hold on. Let me look. Oh, yeah. The public square park. You know, I'd like to see, maybe I can do this after we get off, but I kind of want to do like street view so I can really see like what this looks like on foot and try to imagine what this was like in the middle of the night. I mean, it's not even that late at night. Like, this is 10 p.m. we're talking about on like a weekend.
You know what? It's because I think that park, it almost looks like a New York, like Riverside Park or something. It goes all the way across, like all the way down, like through with the river. Mm. Like, I wonder if he went into the park and there were, you know, it's dark. Going into a park at night is always, you know, a little scary.
I mean, I was thinking of Central Park in my mind. Like, I was kind of like relaying it to that the second you said New York. But
yeah,
we just have no idea. Like, for whatever reason, something happened where his phone was unusable or it was totally, totally off after 10 p.m. So something happened to him and the phone. That's what it seems like. Now, let's see the next phase of this. I think it was within 4 hours of that night, because, of course, his friends were not able to reach him and they're trying to call him. Within 4 hours of looking for him on foot, his frat brothers actually contacted 911 themselves. And I think they were already standing in front of like a local sheriff station. Like, they were trying to get police out and about to help look for him. And what they reported was that Riley was nowhere to be found. This 911 call is available. Nothing about it seems nefarious or suspicious. I'm not even going to talk about whether or not his frat brothers had something to do with it. I don't think that's even a possibility. They then had to make that call to his parents that night after they talked to the police, his parents back in Missouri, and say Riley is nowhere. They left their homes in the middle of the night and they drove down to Nashville that night to start the hunt. And investigators have been looking for him ever since, because nobody can make sense of what might have happened to this kid. And of course, there are lots of theories. There are lots of tips coming in. And again, I will give a resource in the description of this podcast by the time we post it where you can leave a tip if you know something credible. But there are some specifically eerie claims that this particular shirt that he was wearing, which you might have seen in some of the pictures, it's like a black and white, almost like a checkered button-down shirt. It's pretty specific. Mm-hmm. Some people have claimed that they have seen a homeless person who's been wearing it around town. I could not find anything to back that up outside of like just anonymous claims. So it could just be fodder. Like, it could be absolutely nothing, but that certainly like struck a chord where I was like, there could be something here that we're missing, you know, where he fell in with the wrong crowd on the street or like had a run in with somebody. Like, something could have gone down that was very bad.
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel like anything to you, or is that kind of not enough context?
I mean, that's where just in my opinion, anytime you go into a public space at night, like the park, mm-hmm. especially, I mean, there's a reason why they close them at dusk, is because, you know, there's people that are going to be in there that are, you know, hanging out, or, people go into parks to do nefarious things at night because they can't get away with it in the daytime. I mean, it's always a gamble. If you're going to go into a park at night, you need to know that, you know, that's kind of, so I have no idea if he went into the park, but if he did.
Right, same here. I mean, it could have even been by the water, like what you were saying before. I mean, you're going to run into unstable characters. That's a fair assessment anywhere you are.
Yeah.
But the most chilling discovery thus far, because don't forget, this happened on March 8th and there was no sign of him for over a week, 2 weeks, or just about 2 weeks after he went missing, there were two volunteers who I think were a part of the search party who were looking for him. They were walking along the Cumberland Riverbank when they found something on the ground, which I think is the headline that you saw. Mm-hmm. In the wooded area right off from the river, they found his bank card just sitting there, plain as could be. And I was assuming in my mind, I was like, well, it sounds like it washed up. That's not what people are saying online. They're like, no. This wasn't like just like at the bank, like half in the water or anything. Like, this was very clearly just in the wooded area off from the river. No other belongings have been found at this point, just the bank card. How chilling is that? Could you imagine being a part of the search team and you're walking along the Cumberland River and you just see, you're just pulling things up, like looking for anything, and you pull up what looks like a credit card or a bank card on the ground, and to read Riley Strain on the back. They said their stomach sank. Like, they just felt sick the second they picked it up.
Well, absolutely sick. But as an investigator, I would, it would honestly be a welcomed clue, because then I would know that it's not that maybe there was a struggle, but like he left, first of all, he's left something behind that he wouldn't normally leave behind. So mm-hmm. we know that something, either by his own accord, he was like out of his senses or whatever and might have fallen in the water, or, you know, somebody, there was a struggle there or something happened, but he left something behind that was seemingly important. So we know that there's something here that doesn't feel right.
Does it strike you as strange that just the bank card was found and not the entire wallet? So did he have a loose bank card in his pocket? If well, I'm assuming if like he fell into the water and it just started floating and drifting.
Yeah, but you know, in my mind, I was almost thinking like, did it drop out of his pocket or something? And then he's
like
going
while he
to,
was in the woods, like he was.
Yeah,
walking.
And he's going to look for it. And then all of a sudden somebody spots him.
I could be wrong. I think this was found on the other side of the river, like the last side that he. Yeah, but I, because here's the thing is like if his phone pinged last when he was like right by this bridge. So something happened to the phone where the phone is like turned off. It's dead or it's in the water and it's no longer usable. The phone is dropped. Then I guess we're assuming he crossed the bridge and got to the other side of the river and further down. And again, I could be wrong, but this is the way I interpreted what I was reading. He's definitely further down the river. He was walking in a wooded area and then maybe went to reach in his pocket or, I don't know, was to look for something, pulled out his card, something where his card dropped. That's the only thing I could think of. But they haven't reported any other evidence that he was trailing through those woods, like footprints or anything that could verify like Riley was here.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure his friends have been questioned, but if, you know, one of his buddies remembered that he had a wallet on him, I mean, that's right there. We know something strange about that.
I know. I mean, like I said, they've been very cooperative and I really don't think that any of them are suspicious whatsoever.
Oh, not them at all. Not them at all. But I'm saying it would be wonderful if somebody could remember if he just had a loose bank card or if he had a wallet on him.
Also, that just scared me the way you said that. I like jumped.
Oh, God. Said what?
You just I just wasn't expecting you to chime in. You just went, oh, God, not that at all. And I was like, oh, like took my breath away for a second. I was like, well, not that at all. You're right.
Not that at all. No. Well, you know, I feel like Greek life gets such a rightfully so in many cases, but rightfully so in other cases. Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't want it to sound like I was saying, you know, anything about the friends.
Got it. I mean, well, when people first read the headline, that was the first thing they jumped to. They were like, oh, because I mean, it was kind of billed as like fraternity member goes missing 22-year-old. So everybody immediately assumed they're like, this is like hazing gone wrong or his friends are behind it. It sounds like that was completely out of the realm of possibility here. Riley was under the influence of something, walked off. Nobody could find him. And then something happened near this bridge. We don't know.
Yeah.
So like I said, the story is still an ongoing effort. And this is just so recent that anything could come up at any time. So we'll wait to see what happens next. But I think most of what's driving a lot of the momentum around why this is getting so much traction in the media is that this is potentially being linked to the Smiley Face Killers, which is a conspiracy that I am going to get into now. This is going to launch us into this very long-standing theory, just so I can give you like a top line of it, of a silent operation of serial killers that have been targeting young men who fit the exact same profile all throughout the United States, but specifically in the Midwest and the Northeastern regions of the U.S., but not exclusively. There are even some claims that this has gone international. So I will first give you some backstory on just how some of these dots were originally connected to create the conspiracy of the Smiley Face Killers, and then talk about why this might be relevant to Riley's investigation. But I should check in with you. How are you doing so far, just from everything we've talked about, Riley? Because I know that was a lot to unpack before we're going to get into a whole host of other things.
Well, I'm scared to. When you said Smiley Face Killers, a literal shiver went down my spine. Also, because I don't have a jacket on, the window's open. But something
preach
about
it, girl.
But something about like smiley face is just unnerving to me already.
You might have heard about this. You may not be aware of it, but I'm sure you might have heard about, or maybe like seen an article about it in the past, because this is a long-standing conspiracy now.
Yeah, maybe you've touched on it before, but I really don't know anything about like why they're called that.
Yeah, I mean, people have asked us to cover it for a while, I would say, but we usually don't dive into conspiracies on this show. I mean, we talk about theories, of course, but the theories mm-hmm. are usually rooted in like a very real case that is currently going on, or one that we're looking at, and there's substantial evidence that can, I don't know, we can relay to a theory. But this is a full blown conspiracy, but it comes from a pretty credible source. So to give you a little bit of context and some history on the emergence of the theory, this dates back to 1997, and it was spearheaded by retired New York City detectives Kevin Gannon and Anthony, I think it's Durate. I think it's Durate is his last name. There's also a third person who I think is Mike Donovan, who was another detective who's also involved in this. And then there's also Dr. Lee Gilbertson, who is a criminal justice professor and a gang expert. He studies gang and organized crime activity at St. Cloud University. So Kevin Gannon, the lead detective who first worked on this case or brought this case to light, this theory, he worked in the Bronx for quite a bit of his career. He had a career that spanned over 20 years, and this was prior to his retirement that he actually first started to think about the connection to what he called the smiley face murderers. He is, or at the time of his retirement, was the most highly decorated detective in the history of the NYPD. Just for the sheer number of cases that he had seen and the criminal operations that he had uncovered, we could say of all the county we've looked at, he is certainly a seasoned detective. You know, like he is city police. No small town crimes for this guy.
Right, right, right.
But like I said, he's the first person who kind of brought this theory up, because it all stemmed back to one specific case that he worked on. As a top line for the theory, this suggests that there is an alarmingly similar string of mysterious deaths of young men that have been connected over a period of decades, where these men go missing during the night, right after having a drink or two out at a bar or a party. They then show up weeks later in bodies of water. One of the strangest details that potentially connects all of these cases is that the bodies that are found in these bodies of water, they only show decomposition consistent with maybe a few days of being dead and submerged in water. And yet these are people that had been missing for weeks, sometimes months. Many of these bodies are also found with GHB in their system, otherwise commonly known and referred to as the date rape drug. And the most chilling connection of all, and why this is actually coined, the smiley face murders, near many of these bodies, in fact, upwards of 40 to 70, there are spray painted smiley faces found on the landmarks near the bodies, on a rock, on a bench, a tree, or a bridge. Because of the shocking similarities in these cases, these detectives, they picked up on the consistency of these findings and believe it is possible that dating all the way back to 97 until now, as recent as this month, there may be upwards of 230 plus different cases of young men who showed up dead in the exact same way, and it was under the smiley face killer or killers. There are 70 of those cases that these detectives feel are irrefutably connected to this conspiracy. They check all the boxes. Young man, like young male, goes missing after a night of drinking or partying, found dead in the water, GHB in the system, smiley face marker found near the body.
Oh, God. And they're sure that the GHB and the smiley face thing is the, like, a connection.
Well, I mean, this is why this is a conspiracy, and this is why these detectives have been working for decades, basically, to try to get major law enforcement and even the FBI to take this seriously, that there is a connection here. But there are lots of theories that kind of work on the other side of the spectrum here to try to discredit this, and they say, well, the smiley face conspiracy has gotten so big that maybe this could be a case of copycat killers, or it could even be a case of just coincidence. I mean, smiley faces are a very common thing that people graffiti, and that's been true since the 90s. So if it's a case of young men who just get drunk and they go near a body of water for whatever reason, maybe it's to pee or something, and they slip in and never get their way out, do they just show up and there just happens to be a consistent through line here that they're all like in their early 20s, they were drinking at the time, and then they show up near a graffitied portion of the riverbank?
Because that was my first thought, was that, you know, I see graffiti a lot of times, like especially if mm-hmm. I'm running like over by, like, you know, there's a bunch of bridges around me. There's tends to be a lot of graffiti that looks the same. Mm-hmm. I see smiley faces. I see, you know, the same phrases and stuff. So
yeah, people don't have bright ideas when they're like in the middle of doing it. They're looking at like what's around sometimes.
Right. So that was kind of my first thought, being, you know, the the cynic I am. I was like trying to think, okay, but why, you know, smiley faces are oftentimes graffiti. But I think that is really weird that it's the GHB thing, because to me, you know, that's very specific to like go after somebody at a bar.
It's not a common recreational drug. To a young man. Yeah. It's not common that somebody would take that themselves for a night out.
Right.
It's a date rape drug. You're going to be unconscious at some point. But the question is Riley's case the most recent potential link to yet another attack of the smiley face killers? So I'm going to walk through how this all started, some of the history, some of the most prominent and chilling cases that are connected to this theory. And then at the end, we can kind of circle back and re-examine whether or not Riley's case makes sense. Because at this point, he's been gone for almost 2 weeks, and there are a lot of people who are suspecting that in the next couple of weeks, as grim as it is to imagine, and I hope that this isn't true, we might find a body. And there might be some consistencies here. So let's first talk about the profile of the victims, because there is a consistent through line here. And I can show you a picture, a little collection of just some of the victims. But the clear takeaway that I think you already can get, and what you're going to get from these visuals, is that they're mostly just young, college age, handsome guys. They're usually white guys. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let me send this to you in our chat.
And they're almost always out at night at a, well, I assume so, because it's the date rape drug.
Yeah, it's almost always a scenario, usually where they were out at a party, out at a bar, they were drinking, and at some point they walked off on their own, or they got very, very intoxicated out of nowhere. Like, seemingly, it just was inconsistent with like how much people saw them drinking. And what's crazy is some of the cases that we've covered in the past have actually been connected to potentially being a part of the smiley face murders. People have talked about Brian Schaefer's disappearance. People have talked about Brandon Swanson's disappearance and whether that could be connected. So a lot of them just kind of fit the bill, right? Young, academic, mm-hmm. athletic. So let me circle back to this research. And like I was saying, some of the first connecting descriptors, we've got young, college-age men. They're usually athletic, described as handsome. They all go missing, like I said, while they're out on a night drinking. And the drinking element seems to be very important, especially for the GHB theory. Now I'm confusing myself. I'm like, was it GBH? GHB. What is it? The Georgia Bureau of Housing.
Oh, GBH.
I don't know. I think I messed it up. Hold on. GHB. It's definitely GHB.
GHB sounds like more of a thing.
It is. It definitely is. I'm just confusing myself. But the first case that is often referenced as the inception of this huge string of murders dates back to 97. Detective Kevin Gannon, who is the one who pitched this whole theory, he was assigned to the case, and the victim was 21-year-old Patrick McNeil. So Patrick was a junior at the time. He was an accounting major, I think, at Fordham University, where he was described as wicked smart kid, very accomplished, a bit of a ladies' man was what his friend said, and he was an athlete. Again, the athletic component is very specific to these victims. Mm-hmm. And then I think on February 16th when he was out, 1997, Patrick was out with friends in Manhattan at the Dapper Dog. Do you know that bar by any chance? I don't know if that's still there all these years later, but it sounded familiar.
I don't. It does sound familiar, though, but I don't.
The Dapper Dog, it's up on like 90th, I think, East 90th, somewhere around there. It's a cold night. And from the description of the original case report that I found, Patrick was shockingly intoxicated out of nowhere. Like, he had been drinking with his friends, but suddenly he was at the point where he's like vomiting in the bathroom, throwing up. And he came out of the bathroom and he told his friends, he was like, I have to go home. Like, something's wrong with me. I'm really drunk. One of his female friends who was there, she was like, I'll bring you home. She's like, I'm going to accompany you on the train. She's like, let me just run to the bathroom real quick. And then I'll make sure that we get on the train together and we'll get back to the, you know, the housing, the dorms. She goes into the bathroom. By the time she comes out, he took off, walks off on his own. He's out on foot. Witnesses later came forward and remembered seeing Patrick, probably for the last time, stumbling down 90th Street, East 90th, and descriptions of a mysterious white van that was slowly following him. This was the last night that Patrick was seen alive. So when Detective Gannon, Kevin Gannon, he got, you know, put on this case, there were like thousands of volunteers in New York who were all looking for Patrick, people from his hometown. Months would go by and they had no trace on him until 2 months later, a body finally turned up. It was Patrick's body 21 miles down the East River that emerged. And there were some signs there that didn't quite make sense. The body seemed to have virtually no physical trauma, no wounds, although there were some reports, although this is inconsistent in the reporting that I was looking at, that were claiming he might have had restraint marks around his neck. But ultimately, they found this case to be a situation of an undetermined death, but most likely accidental, wasn't examined as anything nefarious or a homicide. This did not sit right with Detective Gannon. So he looked through the medical report, and he found an anomaly, something that stuck out to him that seemed unexplained. Patrick's decomposing body was found with fly larvae on it, something that was later found to be a near impossibility given how cold the waters were, because something that I didn't know. When it comes to decomposition, flies need a temperature of around 75 degrees at minimum, I think, in order for them to lay their eggs. That was not the case. If we're assuming this body was submerged for 2 months in the water, freezing cold water, and yet he had fly larvae on and in his body. They also found the location of Patrick's body in the East River to be kind of strange, because in order to actually get from East 90th Street, and you might have a better mind map for this than I do, but in order to get from East 90th Street to the river, I think there's a pretty infamously busy highway that you have to cross to get into the water.
Yes, the FDR.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, so nobody seemed to see him crossing this highway to get to the water. And it's almost impossible to imagine that he could have done that considering how drunk or intoxicated he was. And yet somehow he's found in the water 2 months later.
You know what is interesting? I'm just pulling on some threads here, but one.
Please do.
That area where he was is a very famous area for like going out, young, like frat kind of profile.
Even
for
back
young
in the
guy.
90s, is that common? Was that?
I mean, I don't know, but okay. In my 7 years of living there, it never changed. Just an area called Yorktown. It's like famous for being like kind of yuppie central, like going out, having, you know, drinks, people getting very intoxicated.
Didn't you live like near the 90s? Were you on the west side or the east side, upper west?
I was on the west side, but the east side, like, I know exactly what that area is. If it was like 90th and First Ave and Second Ave, like, that area is a big bar hopping hotspot. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'm kind of pulling on is that totally for him to get into that river, he would have had to have probably walked down and found a way to get like into the park that's kind of like under the highway or like around the highway or a bridge.
Is there a way to do that? It sounded like what struck people when they were reading this, they were like, it seemed irrefutable that he would have had to cross that highway in order to get to the river. But it sounds like there would be other ways from what you're saying.
There would be other ways. I mean, you'd have to walk down and find like a path to get to they've got like sort of a not a boardwalk, but they definitely have a walkway that's over by the river, but you definitely have to like find your way down there. without crossing the highway. Like, you'd have to know where to go to get down to that little area.
But this is a good point, though. Bridge. You're saying that there's a possibility. I mean, there is a possibility he could have done this without any witnesses seeing him try to cross the highway. I guess my question is, one, the fly larva is still unexplained, but also, two, why was he going to the water?
Right.
He could have just been drunk out of his mind and confused, but why the water?
It's making me think why Riley went down to the water, too. It's just a weird, like, I feel like we're almost looking into the past to get some context about the present.
That's going on merch as well, unfortunately.
Oh, God.
Pulling my notepad out now. But, I mean, this is the inciting incident where, you know, Kevin Gannon, when he's looking at the case, he took an interest in trying to uncover what he believed to be the truth about Patrick's death. But he had no idea that this would take him on a 20-plus year chase that would spiral into this conspiracy, because he now believes, in hindsight, that Patrick was the first victim of the Smiley Face murderers. So Detective Gannon and then Detective Anthony and then Mike Donovan, who comes into the fold, they are all in the mix of this. I think they are the three leaders. The consistency of the clues that were presented led them all, because they're very senior, they sort of know what they're talking about, they know what serial killers do. It led them on this MO run by Detective Gannon, where they were like, we're going to basically avenge what happened to Patrick and get his family these answers. But in the midst of that, they started connecting the dots on all these other cases of young men who were just showing up in these bodies of water. It wasn't until, I think, maybe a few years after that they started to connect the dots about the Smiley Face graffiti. And that's where they, you know, coined the name the Smiley Face Murderers. It seemed intentional that if it was coming from whoever they thought was responsible for these murders, that it was a symbol to connect all of them from different states, different locations, different bodies of water, a visual symbol to let people know we were here, we did this. So in their research, as they started following case after case from the 90s through the early 2000s, the most consistently troubling detail was that all of these men, nearly all of them that they looked at, they would go missing for weeks to months, and then the bodies are found, they show up in the water, but the decomposition, as I said, only indicates they have been dead and in the water for a few days. There were some instances of men who were missing for more than a month and then found with just 3 days worth of decomposition. And because of resources and depending on the town or the county that holds the jurisdiction that looked into these cases, they were either labeled as accidental drownings or even a suicide, but they were just not investigated as homicides. There was nothing physical that could indicate this is something we need to dig deeper into and investigate the death as a homicide case. An unharmed body must be an accidental drowning, when in reality, there could be something else going on here. What was ignored in dozens and dozens of these cases through the early 2000s is that they all seemed to have the connecting visual found by the body, which was later uncovered when these detectives pulled crime scene photos. They were the ones who connected all the dots on the smiley faces. Could you imagine that?
Oh my God. So they believe it's a group.
Yeah, I have a quote here about what exactly they think it is. In fact, let me skip down to it. Let's see. Crimes were so spaced out. Well, that was the thing, is they started to connect all of these dots and they realized just how widespread this was. I mean, this was like a multi-state operation, it seemed like. So suddenly the conspiracy was shifting from them believing there is one sole serial killer behind this. They then believe it is an organized network of serial killers. This is a direct quote, which I think came from Kevin himself. He goes, the smiley face killers are a group of well-structured or organized individuals with cells in major cities around the United States. They came to this consensus as a collective investigating this by 2008, that after more than a decade of looking at these cases, it is a full-on network of murderers, and they work in teams in each cell. Mike Donovan, I think, gave another quote on this, and I'll paraphrase it. He said, for the different cells that are operating out of different states, there are upwards of 8 to possibly 20 different serial killers working in a group in one night, one effort to plot to drug, do the following, do the capture and abduction, and then the discreet murder and disposal of these young men. It is a group effort to capture them and do this, and no one knows why. They also believe that there is a ritualistic component to the dumping of the bodies in the water and then tagging the smiley face to communicate to both the other cells in different parts of the country and to the investigators who were on their tail. We know that you know who we are, and we want you to see what we're doing.
How sick. I mean, like, why? Just the thrill of a kill?
There's no real way to, like, explain, I guess, the psychology behind maybe the power in numbers thing, where, like, somehow these guys somehow found each other, if this is real. And this is something they do for sport in an odd way. I think there is something to be said about the consistency of the target. Young, affluent, handsome, athletic college kid.
Yes.
There's something there to that. Is it envy? Is it jealousy? Is it residual anger to guys that were wrong? Because this actually stems into another theory that Kevin and his team put together, where the highly elusive nature of these murders and the discrete operation of all of it, if these cells are real at a national level, this has led them to believe that these killers could be connected to or are former or current cops.
Oh my God.
So what they're suggesting is that it is a network all across the country of people who have enough knowledge to carry out the capture, the murder, and discreet disposal of these boys. They call in favors to make evidence disappear when it's needed. And to be able to do so, they have to be invisible through the operation, because nobody suspects when you see a cop or cops out in the middle of the night that they're going to be linked back to anything having to do with a serial killer.
That would be so insane. It's also very interesting to think that these detectives came to that as one of their theories, you know, like just that kind of insidious, like them recognizing it could be the call is coming from inside the house.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
Somebody that they know is very, very scary. But it is like, I've just been, as you've been talking, staring at the photo you sent me of all the different guys. And it is just weird that they all look about the same age. They all look about the same profile. Like, it's just very bizarre.
Can I send you a picture of the smiley faces?
Yeah.
All right. Sending that to you now. It's a collection of the smiley faces that were found at various scenes through the years. They're all very different. I will say that.
Yeah.
It's just strange that some of them are located in places where I wouldn't necessarily assume graffiti to be. You know, I mean, maybe it could be, but it's just an odd detail. It's even possible that it could have nothing to do with these smiley faces. That's just a weird, like, common thread. But
yeah,
the actual conspiracy of this network is, like, real. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
That last picture you sent me.
They're so scary. But there are, I mean, there are hundreds, potentially hundreds of these cases that I could zero in on. But I wanted to pull for you one of the most chilling that I read during my research that, honest to God's due, it sent like a shiver down my spine. It's of Todd Giebe. So Todd was a 22-year-old. He was born and raised in Michigan, good family who adored him. He had three sisters. He was a young uncle, and he worked a really solid job, I think at a distribution company, and he lived on his own with his cousin. And again, all of this goes down at a party where he's drinking. He fit the bill of what the smiley face killers might go after, because he's young, he's tall, described as athletic, handsome guy. Todd disappeared under some very strange circumstances in June 11th, I think of 2005, I'm pretty sure. He was out at a party. So it was 12:45 p.m., and he was at like a keg party at a house after he had come there with his friends from the bar. There was some kind of a fight that broke out right around 1 a.m., It had nothing to do with him. I don't even know if it was anybody that he knew, but basically it kind of like broke up the party where people were like, okay, the night's over kind of thing. Instead of getting in a car, I think he was very, very close to his actual home. It was only like five some odd minutes driving. So he's assuming he's going to walk back on foot. So he called his friend right after 1 a.m. So he had a cell phone on him. And he said, oh, I'm walking back on foot because I'm so close. After that call, something happened. Todd called another friend and apparently left a message saying, "I've had enough." Nobody knows what that means. I've had enough. But I'll tell you in a little bit what I think it means. I'll keep going. He then called another friend and said that he was in a field. And then while on the phone with her, the call cut out. And I'm immediately getting flashbacks to like Brandon Lawson. Like, I'm in a field.
I thought the same thing.
Bone chilling. So she tried to call him back. When she got on the phone with him the second time, all she heard was him panicking, like breathing, and like the sound of like rustling on the ground or something. That call ended. That was the last time anyone heard from him. Todd went missing that night. Now, what horrified me and connected this back to the smiley face killers is that 21 days later, Todd's body was discovered in a private lake in Michigan that was fairly close to this area. The chilling part is that the lake had already been extensively searched and they had found nothing in the previous weeks during the hunt. When they found his body, it was described that he was positioned in the water, standing up. Which physically made almost no sense to me, but the way they described it was as if he walked into the water like he was like wading water with like feet to the ground, feet to the sediment, and his head and shoulders are exposed and was just dead in the water. Not belly up, not face down, stood straight up, head poking out of the water. They never found him previously, so how did he just appear? According to the report from the scene, Todd's head and shoulders, like I said, were sticking straight out of the water and were fully exposed to the open air of the summer because he was found in July. So what they assumed was that he must have been in that water decomposing for 21 days. His body only showed decomposition maybe consistent with up to 2 days in that water. And yet he had nothing on his body that could explain a story of a murder, of a homicide. The examiners who looked at his body, they were mostly perplexed by his face and his clothing as they seemed to have no buildup of like slime or algae from the water and specifically no insects. The examiner said, usually like when a body is out in the open, especially in warm air, insects will kind of congregate near the body and start to lay eggs within hours to days. So if we're to believe that he was sitting in that water somehow for 21 days and then just emerge to the surface and there's no insect life, seems virtually impossible. They also looked at his tox report. They did find alcohol in his system, which made sense. And they also found an antidepressant, but no other substances, no GHB, nothing that could explain something consistent with the smiley face murders. But the real link here that connected it back to the smiley face cases is that right outside of the water, on a tree, was a painted smiley face. And then when he was buried, a couple of weeks later, mysteriously, a smiley face sticker appeared on his grave.
Ooh.
Now, I could go on. I mean, there are so many different cases that are potentially connected to this conspiracy, even down to like the consistent... there are some other details that have been consistent from scene to scene, like people reference seeing boot prints at certain scenes, which I'm like, okay, that's something. And then there's even one case I was reading about where the body that was found, the clothing had like remnants of like highlighter yellow paint. It was connected back to the paint that was used to spray paint a smiley face near where the body was found.
Oh, see, that's really weird.
I'm telling you, Stu, like when I read that, I was like, this is real. I mean, it's either a copycat killer or like this is really happening.
Right, right.
But it's just, I mean, the elusiveness of all of it, because you would assume if it's a copycat killer, they're going to be able to like peg somebody. Like they're going to find a culprit. They're going to find somebody connected, some witness who's going to track somebody down. And then they'll confess to being a copycat killer. There's just no explanation. There's no one who's ever found.
I just wonder how long they, like if it is this group that they track someone, or if it's like, you know, in the case of Riley, clearly that was an opportunistic moment, you would think. But it's like, could they have been, I don't know how long they had been down in Nashville. Could he have been sort of hunted in that way, which is literally giving me chills.
Well, I kept thinking that, I guess this is a good way that we can segue into talking about how Riley's case connects to it, because that really is the big question here that everybody wants to know. Is Riley the latest victim? And like I said before, I hope that we are wrong. That's my hope, that we are wrong and that somehow, some way, Riley is found safe and alive. It's just the parallels to all of these cases that we're looking at. It's disturbing. It's disturbing to talk about, because it seems like he's the exact person that this conspiracy targets.
Well, and it's the thing that's making me think it's more and more of a possibility. It's just the proximity to the water mm-hmm. and the proximity to being snatched seems to kind of align with these other cases that you've discussed. They seem to get taken or go missing kind of at the same time and place, like the same time, meaning a little bit after they stumble out of the bar and place, usually near the body of water.
Do you think it's possible that he might have been stalked, let's say, or maybe he was being hunted earlier on in the night, and then it was kind of like whoever's behind this, one guy is sort of like softly on his tail, and his sole job is like the drugging of the drink or one of his drinks. It could have even been that maybe wherever he was drinking before then, I don't have any information on that, that drink was drugged. And then clearly Riley, 6'5", is like beyond comprehension, so, so hammered. He's off on foot. The next phase of the plan goes into motion, which means tail him until he's alone in the dark and you've got your moment.
I mean, I know there's probably some creepers that are sitting on the other end going, that seems like a lot for somebody to concoct in Nashville. But I mean, I know personally stories of male friends that I know where there was somebody in the bar that was set up to go and put something in their drink. And yeah. It came out later. And it was, I mean, you know, it was somebody that had come up and befriended them at the bar. Like just a random person kind of being chummy with them, being like, let me get you a drink. Like, and then all of a sudden, hours later, the person's gone.
Well, it's almost strange, because if we concede to this idea that the smiley face killers do work in cells, they work in groups, and we're talking about like 8 to 20 different people working in an organized way, we have no idea like how many moving parts there could be to an operation like that. Like maybe there's one person whose role is to like cause a distraction in the bar, while the other person's mm-hmm. role is to drop something in the drink, while the other person's role is to wait till they get outside of the bar and tail them with their car. And then the other person's role is to abduct that. Like there could be. And the other thing I will say too, is that I know this conspiracy kind of heads into the territory of like, well, the people who have the resources, the knowledge and the connections to carry this out and be invisible are cops. It is strange to me that the very last person who we could verify saw him and it's on camera was a cop. I'm not saying he's involved. I'm not suggesting that, but it just struck me as odd that less than what, 5 minutes later, after this cop literally talked to the kid, his phone mysteriously stops pinging.
Oh my gosh.
It was odd.
Wild. I mean, and I'll let you get back to it, but it really did shock me when I had a little bit of a personal experience hearing about this from someone else. Like, I was just like, that seems crazy. There were multiple people involved in getting this person in a predicament. Multiple. That were all within the same bar, not talking to each other. So it is possible.
Absolutely, it's possible. And it's also something that people, like pedestrians or people around you in a bar, aren't always keeping an eye out for. They're not looking
Nashville.
Yeah, well, they're not looking to see if like anybody drops something in a guy's drink, usually. Right. Like, especially some dude is walking around who's 6'5". Like, he's not getting poached kind of thing. Like, he's not being targeted.
Right.
But that very well could be the situation we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, how is all of it sort of landing for you? Because this is, like I said, I don't really have theories or anything here. And I don't want to speculate too much because it feels like there's a sense of agony in that because there's so much unknown here and it's so fresh. But I definitely see what people are getting at when they're saying there's a real connection here and people should talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think it's impossible that, you know, he could have been I guess stalked is the word you used, or like hunted. Like it's certainly a possibility. At first though, when we were talking about it, I was coming from the mindset that he got, you know, heavily intoxicated and walked out into a space where that late at night it gets dangerous. And that somebody would just maybe want to take advantage of him because they want to mug him or they want whatever. But I do think it's super weird. What I keep coming back to is that the bank card is there. So, I mean, unless it just slipped out and he did have a wallet on him, you know, financially, it doesn't seem like they were after, you know, his bank card. But I mean, that could have just been a fluke. It just fell out while they were like mugging him or something.
It could have been anything. What struck me was like some of the claims that people saw a homeless person who was wearing his shirt. I don't know if that's true. I can't verify that, obviously, but that freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, do people ever think with these smiley face victims that are they almost always sure that there's like a homicide element to it, like a foul play element? Or do they think some of them kind of just like, and I hated to even speculate this before, but like, could they have jumped off a bridge or something, or like wanted to take their own life or had a battle with some mental illness?
Like you're saying, so how does the conspiracy play into that? Like, these are just
like
kids who were already planning to take their lives, and then the smiley face killers just come in to like leave a mark or something?
Well, you know what? I guess I'm forgetting the one key element, which is the GHB in their system.
It's not always consistent. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them, I think the bodies that were investigated, like their real killer is usually undetermined or it's a drowning. So if I had to guess, it would be a scenario where these boys are captured and then maybe drugged or maybe not. But eventually how they do die is they're drowned. Now, the question is, it's difficult to determine. Well, do they drown from jumping off a bridge the night that they disappear and they're like lost in the water? Or are they captured by whichever group or person captures them? And then they're held underwater when they're done with them for whatever they capture them for.
Yeah. It's just, I guess that's the reason why that came to my mind, is that it fits kind of the profile that we've talked about also in the past, like kind of that age where a young man might be having a break of some sort. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of through line there.
It's possible. That's a really good point that you bring up, because I'm going to bring up another point that I read about where most of these cases of the young men who are found, who allegedly drown or like fall into the rivers or jump, they think they, you know, jump off bridges, they usually have no prior history of mental illness that their families can talk about. And of course, like, things can happen at a moment's notice. Things can happen silently all the time. But I think with all of these connected or suggested cases that are the result of the smiley face murders, they think there would be more of a disruptor in the mix there of saying like, no, this is a person who's been struggling with their mental health, or this is a person who's talked about having, you know, suicidal thoughts in the past. That usually seems like it's not the case. And a lot of people who discredit the theory, I will like, you know, give a devil's advocate approach here. They usually say, this is just a case of young guys who think they're invincible. They're piss drunk. They go to a river because they have to, you know, take a piss or something, and they just fall in and they just can't get themselves out, or the water's too cold and they go into shock, or they black out or something, and then they just wash up. But to say that just ignores a lot of other weird details here. A lot.
It's the GHB for me that's the biggest indicator that there's some sort of foul play out of their control.
I would agree. But although I don't know, the thing is, just like, we don't have a lot of consistent data on the homicide elements of this, because again, most of these cases aren't even opened or investigated as homicides. They're ruled as drownings. It's like an open and closed, like same day thing. So like, a lot of these bodies never got medical examinations. They never had proper autopsies. A lot of these bodies never had sexual assault examinations. They never did rape kits on them. So that's a whole other component here that we could be missing. I don't really know what's behind it. I don't know if I believe in the conspiracy, but I do understand why people asked us to cover it. And I understand where they see the connection here to Riley's case. But Stu, that is everything I've got for you. That was a twofer for you.
Oh, gosh, I hope. I mean, listen, the weirdest thing is that I hope to God he is alive and we find him. But if he is found and they do find something in his system that they're not expecting, I mean, that will be an indicator of if there is a possibility this is connected to something. I hope to God that's not the case, but...
Of course. A lot of people are sort of waiting for the next phase of what happens here. Do we find him? Do we find him alive? And I, you know, I'll say that, of course, part of the reason that I wanted to cover this and I wanted to bring it to you was because people were requesting it, and this is a very big story right now, but his parents are really going through the agony of their worst nightmare fully realized. And from what they've said publicly, the Nashville police work on this has not been great. And retrieving some additional camera footage, even specifically camera footage from inside the bar, which could tell us a lot, has been a very, very tough road for them. Because, of course, like, the bar doesn't want to be culpable or responsible. And, like, they want to present, it's a liability. Like, it's Luke Bryan's bar. And they want to, I'm sure they've got attorneys who are saying, do not give that footage unless they have a warrant for it, or, you know, whatever way they go through retrieving it. But because of that, there are still a lot of questions here and a lot of things that have gone without answers. But I hope for the best in Riley's case. And I hope that at least us talking about his story as recently as it's hit the news could do something to help it. And again, I will leave a resource in the description of this podcast where anybody in that area can leave a credible tip. But as of right now, as of today, Stu, this is where this stands.
Oh, gosh.
Do you need an After Dark episode?
I need an After Dark. I really am. It is so interesting when I remind myself that this is ongoing. Like, we've only done a handful, I think, in our history of, like, covering things in live time. And I'm just like, ooh, like, I really, really hope, I have hope in my heart right now that the next time you and I record, there'll be positive news.
Right. A better update. I agree. So our thoughts go out to his family right now. I really hope that this has done something to at least get his name on the mind of more people who are looking at this case, on the minds of anyone who is close to the Nashville area. But for now, we will put this to rest. You and I will take a break, because I know that was a lot to unpack and that was a lot for me to throw your way at the end of a work day. I'm sorry.
It's a twofer. No, I told you I was ready. I channeled the energy.
Yeah, you said, I'm ready. And I said, you're not, but I'm about to give it to you. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you so much for sticking around for this episode. But for now, we're just going to say goodbye.
And good luck, y'all.
Goodbye, guys. We'll catch you on the next one.
Bye, creepers.